Is your job search stuck? Maybe you're not getting any interviews with employers, or maybe you are, but no job offers. Or you may be new and not even know where to start. This is Charles Max Wood, and I'm releasing a new course and ebook on how to find a job as a software developer. The course walks you through the process of finding the types of companies you want to work for, getting their attention, and putting your best foot forward as the candidate they want. I've coached dozens of developers in looking for jobs and have been able to help several people find jobs within 2 weeks to 2 months. So whether you're new to development, can't find a great job that fits what you want, or are looking for remote work from an area without a strong tech community, I can help. Go to getacoderjob.com and sign up today. I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. Before I introduce our guests, I'm just going to plug real quickly a show that I'm starting. It's called The DevRev. It's about developer freedom. So freedom in your code, your career, and your life. And we're going to talk about, you know, anything that's holding you up from being happy where you're at. So check that out, thedevrev.com. We have a special guest this week, and that is Devin Estes. Devin, do you want to say hi?
Howdy. How you doing, everybody?
Now, we had you on before. I think it was episode 18. But you want to just remind people who you are, since you haven't been on for a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm Devin. I am a developer based in Berlin, although I am American. We've lived here for almost 4 years now, coming up on 4 years. And I, for a long time, was a freelancer, but I actually just started a position as a sort of real job now. So I'm working for a company called Orchard Systems based out of the States, where I'm a senior developer doing Elixir stuff.
Good deal. We brought you on today to talk about testing in Elixir. And it's funny because I just got done recording Ruby Rogues and we were talking about testing the front end on that one. So
nice.
I need to double check and see if JavaScript Jabber today will be the same thing.
Testing is one of those evergreen topics. You know, there's always something to talk about with testing.
It's so true. And, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the benefits of it. But yeah, people argue a little bit about what they want to do with testing and why they do it and how they do it. So I'm curious, just to start out, you know, what are the benefits you get from testing and what's your approach?
Well, testing specifically in Elixir, the big benefits I see are, A, you have some sort of verification about what your code does. You know, Elixir does not have a strong type system, so you do need a little bit more of the testing side in order to make sure that you have some, you know, sort of verification that your code is behaving as you intend it to behave. You also get something that I find very important is tests as documentation. So especially for unit tests, documentation of what a code, what a function does, specifically what's it's expected to do. And that can take a lot of different forms depending on sort of what that function does, whether it's a pure function that just takes in some data and spits out some data, or whether there's side effects involved. And you also, you know, you get some design help if you are doing test-driven design. I find that's less important for me in Elixir than it was in working in object-oriented languages, because in Elixir, just, you know, everything's a function or a piece of data. So, and well, functions are just data. So really, it's all just data. But yeah, I use it much less for design because there, frankly, just is less to design when everything's a function. But yeah, it's, to me, it's just really helpful just to know, like, when am I done building something? Like, I write a test so I know when I'm done working on something and I can consider it shipped. Otherwise, how do I know I'm done?
I was just going to say, I find that doing the design or doing the API design in the test is like the biggest benefit, because you can play with it and say, this is awful, before you wrote the code that would have led to the awful API.
Yeah, but for me, and I think maybe this is one of the reasons why I've never stuck with a typed language, or why a typed language has never really appealed to me, is I find a lot of value by playing around first. And sort of like, it's a little more difficult for me to know, like, I can tell that something is terrible, but it takes me a little bit of poking and playing before I finally find something that I like. I find it very difficult to find something that I like before I've like poked at implementing something. If it's, you know, non-trivial, if it's small, of course the test helps. But if it's larger, like these last 2 days, I've worked on something that's pretty significant, and I had to do like two spikes before I finally found something that I liked. But I personally, I don't think I would have gotten there through just writing tests for the stuff that I needed, because I don't know, it's hard for me to conceptualize something before it exists a little bit. Like, I find it a lot easier to come up with something good once I have something bad that I've written, and to play around with that a little bit first. I don't know. That's sort of, I've always said that I'm sort of like an exploratory developer. Like, I write a lot of spikes. I throw a lot of code away, and that's how I find what I like, because otherwise, you know, I'll write a test and it looks great at first, but then I get to the implementation and the implementation's terrible. Or I write something and I think that it's going to be great in a test, and then it turns out that I've missed, you know, three or four sort of edge cases that make the tests really gnarly, and then the tests look terrible. So I don't know. I bounce back and forth. Yeah. For me, I poke around a lot when I'm developing. I find that's how I get to something good, is by failing a couple times and throwing it away and then starting over with what I've learned.
With that, you were mentioning the idea of like kind of having it be like a playground area. And I've had the opportunity over years of my career of working with different people. And I've seen some people where they will like open up like in Ruby or in Elixir, they'll open up like the REPL and they'll just kind of start hacking code in there as a way of kind of, you know, maybe it's an exploratory spike kind of thing, but maybe it's just oftentimes I've seen them exploring with the code they've just written, and that's mm-hmm. how they're interacting with the code. Mm-hmm. And for me, I find it's much more enjoyable to have that interaction and that playing with my own code that I've just written happening through tests. One of the reasons is because, you know, like I don't have to keep retesting it manually.
Yeah.
That, which is like such a pain. But like, it's also, you know, I kind of view it as like, I see these people, you know, like these coworkers, I totally respect them. They're great people. And it's just, they've kind of come up with a different, I don't know, maybe they've come from a different background and just kind of the path they've come. They're exploring with it interactively in a REPL. And I'm spending a little bit more time writing the code for the tests than they are perhaps, but I end up with something that lasts longer and I get more benefit out of over the long term. So I'm just curious, like it sounded like you were kind of doing TDD at times, and it sounds like you're doing spikes and then refactoring. Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of approach that? Is it, what's your approach?
For something that's small, I know pretty clearly what I'm doing and how it's going to work, I will write the test first usually. But for something that's larger and I don't necessarily know what I'm doing, I will usually do a spike or two or sometimes three, and then maybe write the test once I have some idea of what's going on. Or sometimes if I've thrown away the code twice and I'm on the third thing, I will, if I really like it at that point, I'll just test what I have. There's one side project that I'm working on for myself where it relies pretty heavily on integrations with a couple third parties, including GitHub. And like, I just got it to work, and I've just been testing in production because it's what I do and it's a side project. And basically, once I got to the point where it was doing what I wanted, then I know, like, okay, I can lock this down with tests and make sure that I don't break this. But I can pretty heavily mock out the stuff so that I don't need to rely on hitting the GitHub API and stuff like that. But now that I know this code works, I can really lock it down with tests to prevent regressions, because I don't want regressions in here. So that's another way that I'll do this, is if it's something like that where it's very difficult to test because there are a lot of side effects that you can't really control, like dealing with a third-party API, sometimes just testing it by, you know, pushing code into production and making it work, or staging or something like that. And then once it's working and you know it's working right, then you can cover what you have with tests knowing that it's working. And if you test what you have completely, then it shouldn't break unless the third-party integration point breaks.
Yeah, so I've over the years found that I kind of can't do that. I feel like I should toy with it again. But I've gotten very, maybe blinded, but definitely very in the groove of just writing the tests till they feel right and then making the implementation work. But I recently did a thing with Elm where I had like a 1400 line file, which I would never do. And that turned out okay. So maybe I shouldn't be so absolutely dead set focused on not doing untested spikes.
Yeah, I mean, especially on the topic of testing, and especially sort of on the topic of testing in Elixir, I have some things that I consider rules, but I break them all the time. Like, there are some times where it's much easier and better to break the rule than follow the rule. Sometimes you get better tests out of it. Sometimes you get cleaner code out of it. You know, it's the rules are there for like 90% of the time, but sometimes, you know, like the specific thing that wasn't working in this GitHub integration I was working on was I wasn't setting the header very specifically, because I was using one of the experimental APIs where you need to set this like special header in your request. I wasn't setting it exactly perfectly the way they wanted it. So like, if I was testing that the header was being set correctly, I would just be testing against my incorrect assumption of what the code was supposed to do. I needed to actually test it against their API manually so that I could figure out, does this actually work as intended? And now that I know it's working, and now that I know I have the header set the way they want it, I can now test to make sure I'm setting the headers correctly, because I know what correctly is. Like sometimes you need to figure out, you need to play around to know what it should be doing.
I agree with that a lot. Yeah. Specifically regarding integrations, I think that's a really good point, because sometimes either they're documented poorly, or they're subpar documentation, or just they don't work like they said they worked.
Yeah. I mean, in this case specifically, they told me in one place that I needed to set one special header, and they told me in another place that I needed to set this other special header. So I needed them both and not one or the other. So I kept playing around with different combinations. I was like, it's telling me I need to set this header. I'm setting this header and it's saying it's not working. Yeah, definitely with third-party integrations. And for me, for larger features as well, again, like for very large features, it can be difficult for me going into it to have an understanding of all the ways that feature might interact with the existing code. So sort of by doing a spike, that helps me figure out what exactly I need to be testing for when implementing this feature. Like, how is it going to interact with some live running state? How is it going to interact with other parts of the code, so that I know how those interactions, I know how those interactions are going to go. And sometimes I don't see those until I've done a little spike to help me just have more of an understanding of what the feature is going to do, so I know what I need to test for. For smaller things, when you can see, when there aren't many interactions, it's a lot easier. But for me, for larger things, doing a spike or something like that before I write a test just helps me really grasp all of the things that I need to cover. And at that point, once I've gained that information, I can both write better tests and write a much better implementation.
Well, Devin, I know you've had some recent blog posts, and you just in our discussion right now, you kind of alluded to the idea that you have some guidelines or rules, and you can recognize when it's appropriate to break them. And so recently, you had a blog post talking about writing these tests in Elixir, and you talked about some of these specific rules, and I thought it was really interesting. I wanted to kind of talk on this topic because I was reading through these, and it's like, these are a lot of the same rules I have, but I hadn't really codified them. And by writing them down, you've given a codified with examples. So could you just kind of walk us through some of these rules that you've kind of established?
Yeah. So, I think there are, so to be super clear, I'm talking in these specifically about unit tests, which when I think of testing, there's that whole idea of the testing pyramid, where at the bottom, the largest section, you have unit tests, and at the very top, you have very, very high level end-to-end tests or integration tests or whatever you want to call them. Basically using the application as a user would use the application. I believe personally that there is a lot of value in unit tests, and there's a lot of value in those very, very high level integration tests. And I pretty much ignore everything else in the middle because I think there's no value in them personally, especially in Elixir. So in any functional languages, because you're just composing functions, there's very little value in there's very little difference between a unit test and a controller test or something.
So, I will be moderately contentious on this point and argue. I do like to do a lot of mid-level integration tests that wire, three or four pieces together. Maybe not top-down integration tests, but, testing these things, how they interact. And for those, I find specifically that's the only time I'm ever actually going to look at in detail at the APIs of those pieces in the middle and consider how the functions feel. Because normally I'll get them wired up and ignore it. But then 6 months down the road, I might want to refactor. And it turns out I didn't really design it so well. So just the middle pieces. That is, I think, the only benefit I've ever received from those middling integration tests. But I do like it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about, something that can be pretty difficult to test is if you have, let's say, three named processes running in your application, and you need to test the interactions between the three of them. If you do something in one process, it might do something in the other two. Given that that is a pretty difficult but also very specific thing to test, there's some value in that. Like I said, these rules are meant to be broken. But I think for many people, that sort of thing is rarer than you know, people testing at the, like, actually using something like Wallaby to drive a browser and test. And then they also do controller tests. And then they also do like API level tests, which are fairly redundant. And, you know, I'm cool with having something like drive a browser, or if your application is just an API, you can test those API endpoints because that's how a user uses your application. And then if you have integrations with processes, because that is a little tricky to set up. I mean, that's even a little tricky to set up in those sort of end-to-end tests, just to set the state up of those processes in a way that will test the behavior that you're trying to test is kind of difficult. So that's one of those cases where, yeah, sure, that might be a good thing to test in that sort of mid-level integration test. But I don't typically see a whole lot of value in testing controllers or stuff like that. I see most of the value in tests at the unit test level, which, again, the definition of a unit test can vary very significantly. And then at the sort of integration end user end-to-end level, you know, I write very few of those sort of end-to-end level tests. I, you know, have a couple sort of like happy path tests, maybe one failure, one success, maybe a couple failure and success, but not many, just to make sure that, you know, all of the pieces are hooked up together correctly. You know,
yeah, that's also all I do for that middle piece is just like, it works.
Yeah, like you know, you don't need a lot of tests at that level. It's mostly just to make sure that the stuff is hooked up, the pieces are connected correctly, and everything is working as expected if you're an end user. And then you can handle all of the more difficult testing in unit tests. And that's, I think, also more beneficial from a documentation perspective, because typically when we're looking at a function, we want to see what that function does. We don't want to see the application from a user's perspective, because that doesn't give us the definition of the sort of clarity that we're looking for and the resolution that we're looking for, the very, very fine grain resolution of what's going on at that function level. That is really great to see in a test where you have, you know, you have a describe block for the function that you're testing, and that's the only function you're testing in that describe block. And then you have your tests in there that say this function does this thing, it does that thing, it does that thing. And then you have a pretty clear description of what that function should do or is expected to do. That doesn't mean that it always does that. Sometimes tests aren't entirely true. You know, there are times where I remember not too long ago, I was refactoring an implementation of something that was touching a third-party API. The tests were pretty heavily mocked out, and I basically deleted the entire implementation of all the functions in that module, and all the tests still passed. So clearly it can be a little easy to get into those traps sometimes. So the tests aren't always telling you what's going on, but hopefully they are telling you what's expected. So I find a ton of value in that. And on the unit level, you can get a really good idea of what each function is supposed to do. And that's just super, super valuable documentation.
So real quick question for you related to that. So you deleted the implementation and the test still passed.
Uh-huh.
So in Ruby, I have forgotten the name of it and I'm trying to look it up, but I'm not going to find it in time. But there was a sort of test fuzzer that would modify your code and remove stuff and see if
Was it called like mutant or something?
Yeah, something like that. Set of three tools that were similar, and that was one of them.
Yeah, mutation testing.
Yeah, so do you know if anything like that exists for Elixir? Because I'd love to run that sort of thing over a code base. Because it's one thing to have good coverage. It's another thing to, you know, see that, hey, this code literally, it still passes without it.
Yeah, I don't yet know of anything like that in Elixir. There is some value, I think, in property testing and stream data, but that really only gets to the input part. Whereas mutant, if I understand it correctly, it would, you know, for example, if you had something in your code that said like, you know, if this is true, it would change the assertion and say, if this is false, to make sure that it fails if that is false. So instead of, you know, putting random inputs in, you're actually changing the code to make sure, like, if the code is changed, it fails. So I don't know of anything like that in Elixir yet. It wouldn't be hard to write, given how easily accessible the Elixir AST is. So someone could totally do that if they wanted to. I don't think I'm going to take it on, but it does sound like a really cool project. And maybe I just haven't heard of it and it does exist, but it would be a pretty cool thing. And I think it would have a lot of value for sure.
Yeah, I think it'd be really cool. I dropped a link to Mutant in the show notes.
I'm going to chime in here for a second because, you know, you're talking about having written maybe not as many end-to-end tests or integration tests between a couple of different components and doing most of the testing in unit tests. And that's kind of the traditional testing pyramid is, I guess, what I've heard it called. But I've had conversations over the last 2 weeks with Josh Justice, who we just recorded an episode of Ruby Rogues with, and Kent C. Dodds, who's working in the React community. And they both kind of pushed back a little bit and have pushed more toward end-to-end tests with tools like Cypress.io, and then integration tests, and then the details of how the functions at the base level work kind of get checked as needed, as it's valuable to have it. And so it, you know, their focus is a much higher up. And it seems like DHH has also said something along those lines. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that there are these different approaches. And I'm wondering if you see specific trade-offs to writing more end-to-end tests, especially as the tooling gets better, versus writing unit tests. And I'm kind of aiming this at the entire panel.
Well, one thing I think is we're lucky to have really spectacular tooling in Elixir. So we have tools like Wallaby, which I've used, which is great. I'm also a big fan of Boyd Malterer's Phoenix integration test. I think that's what it's called. Which basically sits on top of like the, you know, what would normally be a controller test, but it gives you a really nice API to sort of go through a user flow. But the thing is, they're still really fast. And Wallaby is written in a way so that you can still run those integration tests concurrently. You can still run them asynchronously. And that's awesome. Like, that's the dream for many other languages, and we kind of get it for free. Same thing with Phoenix integration tests. It, you know, at that point, if you are dealing with a database, if your application has a database, everything is going to be run in its own transaction. It's completely safe to run all of those asynchronously. And that ameliorates some of the issue of those higher level tests, which is typically that those are much slower tests. They have a lot more setup. They run slower because they're doing more, they're covering more code, they're testing more things. So one of the biggest issues there is the speed. But the thing that I think that level of test lacks is that, again, the granularity at the function level of documentation. So, you know, there's trade-offs there. Yes, you can completely cover an application by testing it at that level, but you're going to have a lot more redundancy. Because, for example, if you need to test, you know, how one function either returns an OK tuple or an error tuple and how that affects a user, and you need to test that in three or four different permutations, you're basically doing all of the same setup, which could be significant, could be putting a lot of stuff in the database. It could be making quite a few calls and visiting a couple pages. And you need to be doing all of that to test what is essentially a very small amount of functionality in a single function. So it's inefficient at times, but it does give you a very high level of security that your application is functioning as it's expected from the user's point of view, which is a valuable thing for sure. There's a lot of value in that. But for me, I have found that if you have a few of those tests, making sure that things are basically connected appropriately, and you have something like Dialyzer that's hopefully telling you that, you know, you are covering the possible returns from your functions and that you're not going to have issues there. And you have a lot of unit tests, that gets you there. And it gives you the benefit. I feel very secure with that trio of a lot of unit tests, a few integration tests, and something like Dialyzer. I feel very secure with that. And I don't think I would feel more secure deploying an application that's passing to production with that setup than I would feel if all of those tests were written at the integration level, or even just, you know, 50% of those were written at the integration level. Because most of the paths in a code, in your code from the integration level, most of them can be very easily tested at the unit level. And I feel like, you know, saying unit level is tricky. So I'll give my definition of what a unit in Elixir is, because it's hard to define what a unit is, especially in a functional language, because you don't have objects. So you just have functions, you have modules and you have functions. So to me, a unit is anything that a function does within that given process. So when I'm writing unit tests, I am testing, you know, if a given function calls for other functions, I am also testing those four other functions. I'm not going to mock all of those functions out unless those functions have side effects. So it's sort of, you're getting integration at some point if you do view testing at that level, unit testing as that, if you're not mocking out all of the other calls to other functions that you've written, because you're testing basically, if you view the call tree as a tree and all of the possible branches, you're always testing down potentially all of those branches at every unit. So you do have a little bit of inefficiency there, but it is also more like an integration test in some way. I know there are some people that believe you should mock more heavily than I do, that you shouldn't duplicate the tests in that way. But I find it easier both to reason about and, again, as documentation of what a function is expected to do, I find it easier to document that function if I'm looking at what that function is expected to do by not mocking unless there is some side effect. So either it's interacting with a library that I'm using that I don't want to test its interactions, or it has some genuine side effects, or it's hitting a third-party API, something like that. There are some side effects that I do leave in because, again, it's just sort of easier, like database interactions. I test those in unit tests without worry because the Ecto team has done an incredible job of making sure that that just works.
Roughly 60 times a day, I have probably 3 or 4 images uploaded to Google Cloud Storage because they do it on the tests, and I just have it worth fixing.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at a lot of this, and I think there are definite trade-offs. You know, we've talked about some of them. For me, the biggest thing, though, is how it affects my workflow. I like the end-to-end tests as much as possible just because I know that the entire system works front to back. But yeah, and the efficiency, like if it's repeating stuff, I don't care as long as it's fast enough. As far as the rest of it goes, yeah, it has to be fast enough, right? Because if it interrupts my workflow to sit and wait for it, then yeah, I'd rather go down a level and do integration or unit tests. I don't know that there's necessarily a better level of robustness one way or the other, though.
Yeah, I think in general, like most apps do up to 5-ish really important things that the user actually uses them for, and then have login and like registration. And I think you got to cover login and registration because since you don't actually do it that much, it's possible you mess something up there with integration tests. And then like there's 4 or 5 major user interactions that you really want to be sure about. And so I like writing those integration tests and having those drive the sort of the context or whatever the layers that actually do the stuff that the user was trying to do, and then writing unit tests. But yeah, I tend to not, once I've got some broad coverage, and you do get your best bang for your buck in terms of code coverage from integration tests. But once I have some broad coverage with integration tests, I don't tend to spend much time there unless it's like I am thinking about this from the user's perspective, which we should all do somewhat regularly.
But I will also just want to push back on test coverage, because typically test coverage is I ran my test and the code got executed. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's tested or tested well.
No, definitely doesn't mean that. That's why I think something like Mutant seems really, really awesome. But it at least means that, right? I think there's some, I don't think anybody should strive for 100% test coverage, but I think there's, you know, some level I sort of arbitrarily set at 80 that I think is roughly like, okay, we're kind of, this is not the most important thing to focus on anymore, actually getting coverage. I was also just going to say integration tests in Elixir, because of the way that Ecto sandboxes interact with Wallaby or any of the other integration testing frameworks now. Really, really cool. So if you don't know, you can run the integration tests in parallel because each of them has a sandbox in the database. So they're not going to trample on each other the way they would in your typical Capybara Rails test.
Do you run your own freelance business? Or maybe you're thinking about picking up some business on the side. Well, then you need FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the quickest and easiest way to get invoices out to your clients. It's easy to use. It works anywhere, available from any device, on the desktop, iPhone, iPad, Android, and all of your data is backed up and secure. And it makes it really easy to get organized and get paid. You'll be tracking time, logging expenses, and invoicing your clients in no time. You can also save time billing, freeing up several days per month to focus on the work that you love, and you get paid faster. FreshBooks customers are paid on average 5 days faster because there's a link on the invoice that says pay me now. And it's a great way to grow your business. Plus, FreshBooks is offering a 30-day trial. That's right, 30-day trial if you try them out. So go to gofreshbooks.com/devchat and enter devchat in the how did you hear about us section. Once again, for a 30-day trial, go to gofreshbooks.com/devchat and enter devchat in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
Yeah, and even Wallaby, even though it's spinning up a headless browser to drive those tests, you can run that in parallel. Mm-hmm. And it will spin up, you know, it will use a lot of memory because it's spinning up, you know, however many cores you have on your machine or however many schedulers you have running on the machine to run those asynchronously. But you can run actual like headless browser integration tests asynchronously with Wallaby for free. And it just works because I believe it was, I don't know if it was Ecto 2 or 2.2 that they shipped the sandboxing. But I mean, I've never had any issues with that. And I can view a function that interacts with the database as a unit test because I know that that unit test is not going to interact with any other test that's running asynchronously. And that's another one of my sort of rules with unit tests is that unit tests should be able to be run asynchronously. If you can run it, if you can't run it asynchronously, it's probably not a unit test because it's probably interacting with some sort of global state and that's an integration sort of by default. So there are ways that you can get around that, usually by sort of mocking those dependencies. You know, if you have some gen server, you can mock that out so that you can actually unit test just, for example, the messages that you're sending to that server or the data that you're getting back from that server. You can basically mock that server out through its public interface by providing some sort of dummy module as an argument to the test that you're functioning, the function that you're testing. And that's, to me, I think there's a huge amount of value in that because you can preserve the intention of what that test is doing or what that function is doing without having to spin up, you know, these gen servers that you're depending on in that function in the actual production code. And then you can test the gen server independently, of course, but you still need, especially in those cases where you have functions interacting with something like with other processes, not necessarily just a gen server, but, you know, an etc table or some other process, something else running in the VM, you definitely need some sort of integration test to make sure that those connections are happening. And, you know, the messages that you're being sent are being processed accordingly in the gen servers or whatever other process that you're dealing with.
Devin, we've had you on before, and one of the things you talked about was that you're all in on Elixir. And so that was, the idea was that you were, you know, coming more directly from and committing to an Elixir path. I'm just curious, like with testing, since you have these other history or experience with these other frameworks, are there any things that you're missing in what you're able to do with your Elixir testing that you have from these other languages? You're like, wow, it'd be really nice if we could do this.
No, actually. I mean, I think I find testing in Elixir simpler in most cases. Most functions are, in most applications, are pure functions, which is nice. Makes them really easy to test. You know, you don't have to do a lot of mocking. I remember in Ruby, I would frequently do a lot of mocking because I would be testing the interactions between the object that I'm testing and the objects that it collaborates with. And I would be testing messages sent between those objects so that I could, you know, leverage the sort of holy grail of polymorphism that you shouldn't care what the object is and only what the message that's sent is. And in Elixir, I do far less mocking. I pretty much only mock if there's some side effect that I'm trying to basically get rid of for the purpose of testing. And in that case, I actually learned quite a lot about how to deal with those side effects and mocking things out like that from the OO community. And that's actually sort of the way that I learned how to, or how I've developed a way to test functions that interact with other processes.
Did you get any of that from Pooter, Practical Object Oriented Design with Ruby?
Yeah, a lot of that. Also, Sandy Metz's talk at RailsConf in 2013, her like magic tips of testing, where she basically says, like, you know, you test the messages that are sent and you have commands and you have queries basically when you're dealing with messages between objects. So if I'm, for example, or any side effect, I view it as pretty much any side effect. So for example, if I'm using like the file write function, that's a command. I'm telling it to do a thing. And what matters to me is that I'm calling that function on that module. So if I really wanted to, I could pass in a sort of mock object and I could test that I'm sending calling the write function on the write module with the right arguments. And that should give me enough confidence that in production using the real module, it's going to behave as I expect. Now, I don't actually mock out file system interactions because I find it easier to actually test that it's writing the file. But the, you know, that's a thing that you can do. But definitely with gen servers, if I have a function that basically calls a function in a gen server's public interface, I will pass in a sort of mock module, a different module, to basically make sure that I'm sending the right, calling the right function with the right arguments. And that to me is enough confidence at the unit level that I'm interacting with that process as it should be interacted with.
And he's not just saying this. I've seen it.
Yeah. I mean, and there are two kinds of ways that you can interact with another process. You can have something that's a command where you're telling it to do something and you don't really care what the return is. So in the gen server world, that would be a cast where you tell it to do something, it changes its internal state, and it's not really my worry or concern what that process does with that message that I've sent it. I just know that I'm sending it that message and it's supposed to do a thing I want it to do. And then there are queries, which in gen server world would be a call, where you're calling a function and you're expecting a return. But for the purpose of the test, how that process actually gives me back the thing that I want is not my concern. I can just have it return any old thing and it doesn't matter because I'm going to be testing that gen server in isolation to make sure those functions behave as I expect them to behave. I'm going to be also unit testing that gen server as well as the functions that interact with that gen server. So that, to me, gives me a lot of confidence. But again, when you're testing those units independently, especially with the interaction between processes, you definitely need an integration to make sure that it is hooked up, that you're, you know, it is possible to have those two things, because you're using mocks, it is possible to have those two things not line up. There are some libraries in the Elixir world to try and make that less of a problem. There's one called mox, M-O-X, which basically allows you to define a behavior, and it makes sure that that behavior is implemented in both the real thing that you're testing and also in your fake thing that you're testing, your test double. So that should give you a little bit more confidence that your test doubles and your actual implementations are aligned in the way that they should be. But you definitely need integration tests, a couple integration tests, just to make sure that those things are doing what we expect them to do, that those, the mocks and the real implementations line up.
I'm curious if you have any tips specifically around testing these gen servers, named or otherwise, because that's where I found I can do it, I can get it done. At no point have I thought, yes, this is absolutely the way I want to do this forever.
So testing the servers themselves, or
the actual external processes. So like I've spun up a process and talked to it because it's a singleton, or mm-hmm. just any gen server. A lot of times, I mean, obviously I can just do them non-asynchronously if it's named, mm-hmm. or I can allow myself to name it something else. But I don't know, I feel something about, I guess it's because I'm trying to do unit testy things, but it is actually for sure an integration test. And anyway, I don't know if you have like good examples of that, but
Well,
I do it frequently, and at no point am I like real happy.
I was just going to share the approach I really enjoy doing. I use this all the time. So like the idea is to have a gen server, have a struct that models the state. And so then that struct is, you know, I often call it state, and it models all of the transitions from one state to another. Like, you know, in the gen server, if a call is executed, it's basically just calling state, perform this function. So then I can do all of the unit tests on the state about how it's supposed to be actually interacting and the calculations or behaviors it's supposed to have. Then at the gen server level, you know, one of the things I love about TDD is it informs it the way I design my code. It actually affects how I design it. And so I will create a gen server so it's easy for me to, like, especially if it's a named one, I'll have the ability to pass in an option to give it a different name. And then I can have a unit test that is directly talking to the gen server, making sure it's actually wired up to my state correctly. So that's a little bit of a light integration test. So I'm not testing that as thoroughly as I am just my state struct changes. And then, you know, if it's like a named gen server in a system, then I might have one more like higher level integration test, just that, yes, it's actually set up correctly. It's named where it's supposed to be, and I can talk to it. So, but that's the approach I really like. I'd love to hear, Devin, how you've approached those things too.
So one thing I don't do is test named servers, because they are by definition, global state. If you have a named gen server, it is global state. So whenever I have a server that I want to be named, that's an option that you pass in on StartLink. So typically, if I have a server that I want to be named, you can have, I'll have an option of named true or named false, and I have the default name in there, but I can basically say named false for the purpose of testing. And then within each unit test, I have my own little process within my little test that no one else has access to. That's one of the ways that I get around testing named gen servers, is I don't test named gen servers, at least not at the unit level. And then I only test the public interface. So if there is a public interface for a gen server, we have those functions. I basically look at those functions. I usually, if it already exists, I write down, first I go through and I say all the things that that function does. When I call that function, what are the things I expect this gen server to do? And then I try and figure out, like if I'm testing StartLink, for example, I'll make sure that it returns a PID and that maybe it sets some default state, and I can check the state of that process and make sure that it is as I expect it to be after we initialize it, depending sometimes on the arguments that we give it. So, if I give it these arguments, it has this default state. If I give it these other arguments, it has this different default state or initial state. Maybe after init, we have like a continue that we need to test, something like that, which was it Erlang 21? They added that handle continue callback to gen server, which is awesome. I really like it. It can be a little tricky. It means sometimes you are passing in other basically mocks as well. One of the things that I really like to do, especially if there are a lot of asynchronous things, is like if you, in the case of that handle continue, like let's imagine we have an init function in our gen server, and then we continue on to do something where it has to call two other functions or something. To ensure that it is calling those functions, we can pass in a mock for those functions to the init. It gets a little bit gnarly sometimes. Sometimes you end up passing in a lot of things, but in those mock functions, you can send messages to the test process, and you can see that it is called, this function with these arguments, and it's completely, well, not completely a unit test, because we are testing one process sending a message to another process, but it's as close as a unit test as you're going to get, because you're only sending processes messages between the process that you're testing and the test process itself. And I think one thing that is important to make known that some people may not all know is that when you do run your tests in Elixir, they're all run within their own process. Every test gets its own process. So if you're sending messages to self, that is only going to go to the process actually executing that test, depending on where you're writing self. But if you're writing self within the body of the test and passing that PID in, that self is going to represent a unique process that's only running that test. So you can be sure that the code executing in the context of that test is going to be sending messages to that process. So yeah, that's one of the things that I do, is I do a lot of basically sending messages to the test process to verify something was done. And I can pass in a mock that will give me specifically, like, it's called this function with these arguments, and I can verify that functions were called with those arguments. And that's one way to test asynchronous code, is just to send messages to the test process and then use assert receive to assert that you receive that process as, or that message as you expected. But yeah, that's something I do a lot. If people want to see examples, you can look at the tests for Benchy. We have a couple of those because there's a lot of async stuff happening in Benchy and a lot of processes in Benchy. So there are some good examples there where we're basically passing in mocks and sending messages to self to make sure that things are happening asynchronously as we expect, because we can't say, at any given time, we can check the state of gen server and it may be different than it was at the point when we wanted to check the state of that gen server, because it might change two or three or four times over the course of a given function execution. But when we send a message, we can basically get a snapshot of the state at that point in time where we're trying to test at that point in time. So yeah, that's sort of the best way I found to test asynchronous code, is to send messages to the test process and verify that we received the message that we expected. And it can definitely get a little gnarly. I actually heard pretty recently from Claudio Ortolina about one thing that he's starting to play around with, which is having these like context structs, which basically have either like all the production modules and functions or all the test modules and functions wrapped up nicely into one struct that he can inject into these gen servers or these functions that he's testing to give them all of these mocks in one thing, or to give them all of the basically production information in one module. And he has a little repo that I can post a link to that was really, really good, actually. It's sort of this idea of dependency injection that I've been talking about, but more formalized and more, you know, it's probably a little better than the way I'm going about it, but it's definitely another step further even. It definitely makes it easier to test these things. And it does give a good name too to this thing, is you're executing this function within a given context, and that context can change. And that's one of the good things about being able to pass these things as arguments to functions, is because it's very easy to change those functions then when, or change behavior by passing in different things that do different things. So, you know, that's sort of that other great goal in the object-oriented world. And one of those things that the testing in this way was supposed to give you is that ability to sort of being able to change code by passing in different objects and different collaborators without having to change the code itself. So you can do that in that same way by passing in these context objects. And I think it's really interesting. I haven't played around with it much, but the little spike that Claudio put up is really interesting and good. So it's something I think people might want to take a peek at.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I was looking through the code while we talked a bit, and yeah, it's really, really good. Dependency. So I did a Ruby project that was like extremely dependency injection heavy. That was like the thing I was doing was nothing could know about anything except for the top level. And that was actually the first thing that got me pointed towards functional programming. And it's kind of funny to me that I haven't gone out of my way to do anything as extreme now that I'm over in FPville. The reason it pushed me was because the only bug in the program was like something, the only place I used state, like the only place I shortcutted was the only bug in like an extension.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, it looks really cool. I want to pull down shop and look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of hate the term dependency injection in the functional context, because it's really just passing something in as argument to a function. And that's all we do all the time. We have functions and we give them things as arguments. So I think the term is a little academic for our use, but...
I think it's valuable, because if you don't pass it in, then it was sort of a hidden dependency. Like you didn't know this module was depended on. So here you're being very explicit about passing the dependency in.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Like if you are referencing a gen server's implementation directly through the module, you know, those modules are all, you know, they're just atoms. They're globally available. So by passing that module in, as opposed to referencing it directly in the code, you are getting a little extra layer of abstraction, a little seam that you can change things later if you want to.
Yeah, my stance is dependency injection is a fine name. It's Angular that ruined it.
That Java through XML files.
Well, have you seen how Angular does it? It does a string parsing on the function definition itself. It's pretty ridiculous. I have no idea how current Angular does it. I abandoned ship at one.
I was going to say it's a little different with Angular 2, 4, 5, 6, 7.
They're numbering. I love it.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Devin said that I did want to just kind of give a plus one to is the idea of being able to send a message to the testing process, you know, which is self. Like I found that really handy. Like if I'm passing in a function as an argument and it's supposed to be given some state and everything, it's conditionally executed, then I can just pass in an anonymous function that says, send a message to myself, the test process, to say, yeah, I was executed. And I can just assert that I received it or assert that I did not receive it. So I just use that all the time, even when I'm not testing something that's asynchronous, but it's just something that's kind of buried and otherwise difficult to expose. So yeah, I love being able to talk to the testing process. It's something I use all the time.
All right, Mark, do you want to start us off with picks?
For you, Loot Crate is offering an opportunity to save 10% on any new subscription at lootcrate.com. Just enter the promo code BRIDGE10 for 10% savings. Loot Crate is one of my favorite things. Every month I get a box in the mail, costs less than $20, and it comes with all kinds of goodies. I have stuff from, just looking at my shelf, Batman, Spider-Man, Ninja Turtles, Back to the Future, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, and much, much more. So if you're a geek, a gamer, anything like that, and you want cool stuff to put around your office, cool t-shirts, comic books, etc., then definitely check out Loot Crate. To save 10% on your new subscription, go to lootcrate.com/ruby. Again, that's lootcrate.com/ruby to save 10% on any new subscription. Enter the promo code BRIDGE10 for 10% savings.
Yeah, sure. I wanted to kind of following on something I've been talking about before was kind of like my development chain. One of the things that I really use a lot is Git aliases. Like in the command line, I'm interacting with Git, and I work with people, and I've worked with people over many years, and they're like experienced developers, and they're like typing out the entire like Git checkout master kind of command. I was like, you know, Git aliases are really cool and they're really easy. So I put together a little blog post that just kind of identifies some of my favorite Git aliases, the ones that I'm using. In particular, like instead of checkout, like the whole word checkout, I'll just alias CO. So I can say Git CO master. Or if I want to do a Git status, I can just do Git S. And so I'm just wanted to share like, hey, be thinking about Git aliases. If you're using these commands a lot and you haven't used Git aliases, check it out. They're really fun. You can get a lot of mileage out of them. So that's mine.
Thanks for making me feel dumb. Josh, do you have some picks for us?
I do. Now I only had one, but now I have two. So my first pick, which I discussed was, when we were talking before the show, was getpitch.com. And so what GitPitch is it's a presentation tool like built around Git and Markdown. So the idea is you put a pitchme.md file in a repo and you point GitPitch at it and it presents it. And there's lots more stuff other than that. There's like a desktop tool that makes it, it's a little convoluted compared to some other ones, but it's very developer friendly. You run a Docker container and it gives you this desktop sort of web browser based preview for your slide deck, which is really good and does a pretty good job of kind of updating when you make changes, which is what you want when you're developing a slide deck. And then there's also, there'll be a link to it in the show notes, but my slide deck from the Big Elixir last week, which was really, really cool. And I built it in GitPitch. But since we were discussing Git aliases, so I've been playing with other editors. I'm a through and through Vim zealot, but I was using VS Code for a couple weeks for a few things, Dart. And I decided I can't really just like go use VS Code heavily without also giving Emacs a fair shake again, because I kind of never really give it a good shake. So I've been playing with it, and yes, I'm still much, much faster in Vim, but I'm getting where I can navigate around Emacs somewhat reliably. And one of the things that is extremely cool in Emacs is Magit, or M-A-G-I-T, .vc, and it's a tool for interacting with Git, and it's really fast. Like once you actually understand the sort of movement commands inside of it, it's really fast and really, really powerful. Like staging hunks, I normally would use a GUI tool like Git K or something. But you can stage hunks really easily in Emacs. You can like control the state of your index in a really detailed manner. Anyway, so that's my second pick is, hey, at least look at Magit, because it's really powerful. And you don't really get that, you don't appreciate it until you've used it. So like I'd read about it a bunch, but really have to actually use it to like know, hey, that's a thing that probably would have taken me 45 seconds and took two. And I do a lot of those during the day.
So I do have one more I had to jump in with. I'd forgotten about this one. So anyway, this is an article from Platforma Tech, from their blog, like from 2015. So this is an older one. But it is where Jose Valim kind of came out and talked about how to mock things in Elixir systems. And I really leaned heavily on this when I was coming to Elixir. And, you know, in this, they've updated it and said, hey, we created the mox, M-O-X library, which we've linked to in the show notes as well. And as a way of implementing some of these things. But I just wanted to put this out there as a resource that people can refer to, because it's still relevant and everything is still current. So I just want to make sure people are aware of that.
Nice. All right. So I'm going to jump in here with a few picks. So one pick that I have, and this is something that's more of a, not a concrete pick that it's like, oh, go link here. One of the things that my business coach, so I have a business coach who's been helping me, you know, keep the podcast business running and things like that so that we can keep putting out great content for everybody here. He had me write out some values, some core values for the business. And one of them is extreme ownership. And another one is continuous ongoing learning. And what's interesting is having these values has really kind of guided the way that I've done things going forward. So for example, on extreme ownership, I read a book called Extreme Ownership. I think I picked it on the show before. If not, check it out. It's awesome. But I actually wound up buying that for my team, you know, lining things up with the continuous ongoing learning. And I really want to encourage anybody who's in any kind of team setting or team leadership setting to sit down with your team or just sit down alone and figure out what really is important to you. What kind of team environment culture do you want to create? What are kind of the guiding principles for that? And then just go double down on them and make the team and the environment into the kind of place that you want to work in. I've been finding that, you know, empowering myself to do these kinds of things has really, really been a powerful thing for me and for my team as we've produced this stuff. So yeah, I'm just going to pick that and shout out about it. One other thing I want to shout out about is we do have a Discord server set up. So if you want to get the Discord app, I'll put a link to the Discord in the show notes. And that way you can join us and chat with us. There are private rooms for all of the hosts for all the shows, but there are also public rooms for all the shows so we can have conversations there. And finally, Michelle, a member of my team, she did a terrific job. She set up recommendation pages for all of the shows, including this one. So if you have topics you want to hear from us on or people you want us to get on the show, then go put those up and in there. You can also go, it's based around Trello, and you can actually go vote. So you can click on a name or a topic and then click the vote button and it'll upvote it. And that way we'll know, oh, people really do want to hear about this. So anyway, those are my picks. Devin, what are your picks?
I got a new laptop kind of recently, and it's my first Linux machine. It's a Dell XPS 13. And I will say that there are definitely some things that don't work as well as a Mac, which is what I was coming from. But for the most part, it does a really good job, and it's like half the price of the comparable Mac, especially here in Europe where computers are like obnoxiously expensive for some reason. Like to get a top of the line MacBook, it would be cheaper for me to fly to New York and buy it in New York and come back to Berlin and to buy it in Berlin. So yeah. And like, I've heard stories about like Poland and Brazil too, where they're even more expensive for some reason, but computers are expensive here. And this one was actually pretty reasonably priced, and it's has great specs and like for the most part works really well. So for the value, it's great. Like I don't mind that every now and then it does something weird and like maybe the camera doesn't work all the time, but for a work machine, it's great. So I'm pretty pleased with it. The Dell XPS 13, super fast, a lot of memory and not that expensive. I also saw that they released the like a mini PlayStation. And I don't really play video games. I never really did, except the Final Fantasy series. And Final Fantasy VII is on that like PlayStation Mini or play whatever it is. It's sort of like the SNES one that Nintendo released. They did that with PlayStation now. And Final Fantasy, it made me remember that Final Fantasy VII was a really great game. So I'll pick that too. And now that like people can go back and play it again, that's a really great
pick.
Yeah. I look forward to when my kids are old enough to start playing that. Like Final Fantasy VI was also a really great game. And like you can get those on I think that was on the SNES one as well. So maybe both of those, even though I don't really play video games anymore, I would play those again if I had the time. And then my last thing is less a pick and more of a sort of a plug, but I mentioned that I've been working a little bit on the side project, and it's actually sort of about testing. And I would love to get more feedback from people if they have time. We can talk about testing and how this thing might help you write better tests. So if people want to talk to me, they can email me at devon.c.estes@gmail.com. And we can set up some time to talk. I would love to talk to anybody that wants to talk. And even if you don't want to talk about that, if you want to talk about something else, we can talk about that too. I'm usually pretty happy to talk to anybody about just about anything. So yeah, email me if you want.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming, Devin.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it was awesome. All right, folks. Well, we will wrap this one up and we will be back next week.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.